Well, Jean-Marc, thank you very much for the warm welcome. It's nice to be back here indeed. Almost 20 years that we're working together on, looking at the wider security implications of climate change. And I can say this report is not about security implications, even though we touch upon this issue for quite a while. It's a collaborative effort of a group of institutions that have been approached by the G7 foreign ministries a little more than a year and a half ago to ask us on the basis of a mandate that they have, designed to look closer into the relationships of climate impacts, dangerous climate change, and how that affects the fragility of states. They also ask us to set up a global information platform that could help foreign policymakers in order to deal with these systemic changes and systemic threats. The first thing that we discussed with them is that we would like to extend the scope of the study a little bit and not exclusively look at those countries that either call themselves fragile or that are labeled fragile, but look into fragility itself. So to what extent parts of society or pockets or situations of fragility occur. This is reflected in the report. You will find the report and the executive summary outside. We started in April last year, April 1st and 2nd, with a planning meeting in Berlin and ask right on the third day government representatives of the G7 foreign offices to join us. And we told them a little bit how we want to approach the subject and what they could expect from that report. I wouldn't say they weren't satisfied, but at least it took us another two meetings, one in Paris and one in Berlin, where we went through the report. So it was quite an interactive, collaborative effort by those who wrote the report and those who in the end received the report. It was handed over to our Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier in April this year, just the day before the beginning of the Foreign Ministers Summit in Lübeck, and has been discussed there at the summit, and also some of the recommendations that we put forward have been taken into account. I would like to just go through a couple of things. I can't repeat the 170 pages. This is why you have the full story out there, which tells you about the complexity of issues. It tells you about how climate impacts intertwined with more structural deficits and structural components of both fragility and also conflict. The reason why we looked at fragility is because we were asked to look at the full spectrum of mechanisms in society and governance systems in place by government agencies and states, to what extent they provide the necessary conditions in order to build resilience towards fragility and also to address larger climate risks. We look at global pressures and identify the global pressures. It's not just climate change, even though climate change is an overarching pressure on states and societies, but also the question of population dynamics and population growth, urbanization, pressure on resource availability and resource demand, and to what extent that impacts on what we called systemic risks or compound risks that threaten states and society. I would like to go through these seven compound risks just quickly. The first one you might be much familiar with, particularly in this room, those who deal with local resource conflict and how resource competition then leads to conflict. We were looking into the larger and long-term changes, but also sudden shocks and how societies in different rural communities basically deal with this kind of exogenous shocks when it comes to resource distribution and resource use. And what we have learned is that many of already unstable societies where basic conditions that states provide or even local communities provide are affected by sudden shocks or long-term onset change due to climate change, increases instability and even lead to violent conflict, particularly in those regions and areas where dispute resolution mechanisms, both at local level but also at state levels, are not existent. And you find examples of Mali and Sudan, for instance, and a couple of more resource-related, extractive industry-related conflicts that we illustrated in the report. The second one is dealing with livelihood insecurity and the question of migration, even though migration was not meant to be a centerpiece of our report because it cuts across many of the compound risks that we have identified, not as a problem, but as a coping capacity and coping mechanisms of societies. But what we have seen is that climate change will increase and is increasing human insecurity of people who depend on natural resources for their livelihoods. And particularly when they migrate, they often turn into either illegal or unstable, unsecure sources of income. And one of the examples that we used in the report is Syria, where in the north, east of Syria, due to a sequence of droughts over a couple of years, I think 5 years, a large part of the particularly younger population was pushed into the cities. Cities were not able really to absorb this massive influx of people seeking for jobs and thus contributing also to a longer cycle that leads then to civil war and conflict. The third one is very much closely linked to what we normally associate with the risks of climate change. So the increase of extreme weather events, both in terms of frequency, but also in terms of depth and natural disasters. We realized that particularly fragile states that miss basic capacities to address sudden risks and shocks are vulnerable to extreme weather events, particularly when it comes to when they exacerbate the existing safety nets within society and contribute to vulnerability and grievances, especially in conflict-affected situations. Most of these fragile states and fragile societies have experienced already conflict in the past. As you see in this compound risk in the full report, that it is interesting that we both provided the empirical evidence, but also we showed that other countries and other local communities can follow that up. Because it was basically a question, how does the situation look right now, and can we assume if similar crises may occur on the long term, and what kind of countries these are. And in our report, we have illustrated that both emergency responses, for instance, if they are well designed, can either help to overcome existing political conflicts or ethical conflicts, as we demonstrated in the case of the post-tsunami rehabilitation programs in Aceh, but also were ill-designed rehabilitation measures, like at the flooding in Thailand in 2011, can deepen inequality and contribute to social unrest. The fourth risk component is volatile food prices and provisions. We all know that climate change and changing variability and precipitation level can have a significant impact on food production and food insecurity. But when we look at the food security problem, it is not just immediately linked to natural conditions and changing weather conditions, but it's obviously linked to social and economic misconstruction, market dysfunctions, about availability of food at the right time, about the stability of regional food markets, and the readiness of the international aid system in order to provide in situations of crisis sufficient food. So what we have illustrated there is the role of pressure on food prices and price volatility but at least playing a significant role in the Arab Spring in Egypt in 2011, but also social unrest in other parts of the world. The fifth component is transboundary water management. it's often believed, and if you look at studies also carried out here at the Woodrow Wilson Center Environmental Change and Security Program about the stability of institutions in international waters, often said that much of the risks in the past have been managed because of stable institutions, political institutions, basically river basin commissions that helped to bridge increasing demand and limited resources and distribution. But the problem is that in most international rivers, but even in domestic rivers, where additional pressure is emanating from changing water quality and also river flows, is putting a lot of pressure on existing institutions and legal agreements that are in place. So what we have illustrated there, that both interstate and intrastate conflicts may arise, and we illustrated this with a couple of more well-known international basins, but also some domestic water bodies. The sixth one is sea level rise and coastal degradation. It's often put forward, for instance, in the 2011 Security Council debate on climate risks, that small island states are sinking. Small island governments put forward this argument because it was the first case to say that due to global environmental change, countries are disappearing. It's a legal question when a country is disappearing, but the problem in that we have illustrated there is that most of these countries will come under severe pressure already long before they might sink. Because of climatic changes and weather conditions of destruction of coastal areas, deforestation, etc., even though small island states differ very much in its geography, they suffer already from destruction of coastal areas, saltwater intrusion, lack of availability of income opportunities in coastal areas, etc. And sea level rise on the very long run may also pose significant geopolitical, at least pressures, because sea level rise is resulting in changing sea boundaries, which affect then resource use and the question of extracting natural resources like deep sea mining. And seventh one, last one, is dealing with unintended effects of climate policies. Jeff, you did, but together with us, a report called Backdraft, where we looked, that emanated, I think, from a discussion in Copenhagen about the negative effects or side effects well-designed and intentioned climate policy measures can have. And what we witnessed is that we often have good purposes in designing and promoting the exploration and diffusion of renewable energies, but with negative side effects. So the question of biofuels and its effect on food security in the developing world, or an increasing demand about natural resources leading to land grabbing, or the promotion of renewable technologies and the demand for strategic resources and strategic minerals, have negative side effects on the stability of countries and society. So, taking this into account, we looked in the second chapter about across the spectrum of policy areas, and we picked three that we thought are most relevant. One is dealing with climate change adaptation. A second one is dealing with development and humanitarian aid, and a third one with peace building and conflict resolution issues. And we looked at policy initiatives that are in place in different both government institutions and also within the system of international organizations in terms of addressing these very complex systemic risks. And what we have found is that in most cases, both domestically and also internationally, we are a little bit far away from breaking down these sectoral barriers and silos that exist there. And even if we looked at more encompassing policy approaches like addressing climate change and developing, designing, implementing climate adaptation programs in order to build resilience of most vulnerable parts of society or a country, we realize that climate adaptation plans rarely address systematically the question of fragility and conflicts, and particularly when we start applying climate adaptation policies in fragile contexts, and most of the fragile states are considered to be the most vulnerable with regard to climate change impacts is that we have very little both understanding, but also very little tools available that allow us to design adaptation policies in a wise way so that they can pay attention to the very specific conditions of both conflict-affected societies and fragile contexts. We will hear later on, I think, a little bit about what the US government is doing there. I'm not saying that nothing is in place. We have bits and pieces there. We have guidelines, we have guidance notes everywhere. But if you look at the large picture and the large scale, and the kind of evaluation that has been done on climate adaptation programs, there is still a lot of room for improvement. If you are familiar with the humanitarian aid agenda, it has been further developed over the past couple of years in the Hyogo and now the Sendai framework to be more proactive, to forward-looking, in order to build necessary capacities in fragile contexts in order to deal with catastrophes and humanitarian disasters. But what we realize is that if you look at the programs in place, both specific measures or general country policies, they are not really climate-proofed. And so climate-proofing, even if we started already to develop methodologies, is not yet a standard, particularly in fragile situations. And the problem is that particularly when aid money and humanitarian aid is flowing into a country, most of these fragile societies and countries are not well equipped in order to digest this amount of financial flows coming in. A third sector we looked at is peace building and conflict prevention. Climate change is not yet sufficiently incorporated into fragile or peace and conflict assessments. There are methodologies in place, particularly by aid agencies, in doing that. Some of them work well. Both of them in both national and also at the global scale are basically meant to be guidance or help provide guidance and knowledge of how to do things. We have very limited mandatory requirements, particularly in conflict-affected societies and fragile contexts, to apply then a set of measures rigorously. What we suggest to come to the end of what kind of recommendation we provide, you find throughout the report, even in the analytical chapter and particularly in the policy chapter, a lot of very concrete examples that we highlighted that exist already in government institutions or even in non-governmental organizations. But what we ask for is that we don't have a system in place yet that puts resilience at the center of foreign policy. And this is what we actually recommend to develop a new commitment or to commit to resilience and develop a new resilience agenda that addresses the systemic risk in its complexity. And we divided that into three different levels of intervention. One is what we are discussing today also here is do your homework. So that is basically what countries can do, basically integrate climate fragility responses across the spectrum of institutions. We always state that, and we know that our administrations are siloed. We do recognize and increasingly recognize that the interlinkage between climate impact, development, conflict, and fragility are very complex, as we have demonstrated in this report. But we don't have the mechanisms in place and the policies in place. I just attended a meeting a couple of days ago with Achim Steiner on the Sustainable Development Goals, and he recommended really to change the order and not start developing policy programs and measures, but really start working on the political will that is often lacking in order then to put what we recommend into practice. And I think this is where the G7 starts, and what we also recommended in our study, that we need closer cooperation to take existing policy mandates into practice. In the Council conclusions of the Lübeck Foreign Ministers Summit, the foreign ministers agreed to set up a task force. We said high level, they said a working group. No, it's a task force of leading executives in the different foreign offices to get together to critically review the recommendations of this report and to come up with their own conclusions by the end of the year and report back to the G7. We are very satisfied with that. Some here in the room helped us to get this on the agenda of the foreign ministers. And as you might be familiar, no matter how you look at the G7 summit in Elmau outcome, at least there was a very strong statement introducing decarbonization in the language of diplomats. So I think the ambition is clear. We know where we go, but I think it requires a lot of, well, coordination, but also bringing the existing knowledge in different institutions across the spectrum of foreign policy, from environment, climate development, peace building, agriculture, to foreign policy and security policy into the picture. And as I said in the beginning, we were asked not only to write the report, but also to develop an information platform, a global information platform for foreign policymakers and those who work on global policies and politics, which is, as you see in the report, called newclimateforpeace.org, that today in the afternoon, I'm glad that my colleagues managed to do that, put up the information platform that provides more information both on what we have analyzed there, so the empirical evidence that policymakers would need, but also would enable you to engage in a discourse because we have the so-called resilience block that is ongoing there, and a database which is called Factbook, a factbook on climate and fragility that allows you, even as a non-expert on a subject, to download 2 pages and 4 pages on a given complex that introduces you the problem, but also solutions to the existing problems. The third one, to keep it short, is act together and break down sectoral barriers and siloed approaches, basically to integrate considerations of climate, peace building, humanitarian aid into a larger perspective of what we design and outlined as the resilience agenda. And the fourth one is building partnerships both at the global level but also with the necessary stakeholders to build and, to develop resilient environments at the local level. This was introduced because we do not pretend that it is just the question of organizing dialogue among foreign policymakers. It is also lobbying at the global level for UN organizations in order to break the silos that exist. If you look at UNDP's budget for this year, it's 2/3 of its budget is going to 4 countries alone. So you could imagine with the other 140 countries that experience severe poverty and situations of fragility suffer, and what kind of conditions and capacities we have to create and build. That's it for the moment, a snapshot of our report. Thank you.